Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Today's decision represents a huge win for tribes throughout the nation and reaffirms tribal sovereignty.
Alaska tribes cheer a Supreme Court opinion that upholds the Indian Child Welfare Act. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 15th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a report says the well-being of Alaska children ranks among the worst in the nation.
One thing won't solve this because we do not have a centralized, universal system that is ensuring child care for everybody.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Tribes across the nation and in Alaska are celebrating the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act. In a 7-2 vote today, the court rejected claims that ICWA is racist and unconstitutional. KNBA's Rhonda McBride talked with Alaska Native leaders to get their reaction.
There was a collective sigh of relief when the highest court in the land backed the tribes and their right to oversee adoptions involving American Indian and Alaska Native children.
This is something we care deeply about.
Julie Kitka, who is president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, says AFN has been involved in this fight for years because a lot more was at stake beyond protecting children.
A lot of threads of federal Indian law, the authority for the Congress to deal with Alaska Natives, Native Americans, derives from that.
Kitka said had efforts to overturn ICWA succeeded, tribal sovereignty would have seen widespread erosion.
Today's decision represents a huge win for tribes throughout the nation and reaffirms tribal sovereignty.
Brian Ridley heads up the Tanana Chiefs Conference in Interior Alaska. He says tribes have worked for years to improve programs to support tribal adoptions, key to protecting children, families, and tribes, along with their culture and traditions.
All the years of work that we've done to get to this point in trying to protect our Native kids and keep them with our Native families.
The Association of Village Council Presidents, which represents tribes in Southwest Alaska, concurred and said in a statement that ICWA has been the gold standard of child welfare. But during a U.S. Supreme Court hearing last year, Matthew McGill, the attorney representing a white family fighting to adopt a Native child, argued that ICWA had discriminated against them and put the interests of the tribe over the needs of the child.
That means each year, hundreds, if not thousands, of Indian children are placed in non-Indian foster homes. And sometimes there, they bond with those families.
Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote the majority opinion, which leaves the law intact. She cited more than a century of precedent and the plaintiff's lack of standing on the issues. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in his dissenting opinion that the court had allowed the federal government to overstep its powers by displacing state authority to regulate child custody proceedings. The state of Alaska did choose not to fight on behalf of ICWA. Attorney General Treg Taylor said it was a difficult decision not to join, but says the state believed other entities would give the court all the information it needed to make its decision. In a statement, Taylor said, "It does not appear that anything has been changed, and the decision underscores our commitment to partnering with tribes to improve outcomes for tribal children and families." Richard Peterson, president of Tlingit and Haida, the largest tribal group in Alaska, says he is still disappointed that the state did not join more than 500 tribes to fight for ICWA.
I applaud that statement. I agree with that statement, but their actions don't really back that up. If they did, if that's how they felt, they would have signed on and supported tribes in this ICWA battle.
Still, Peterson says the tribes prevailed.
And our sovereignty continues on and on again in these court cases to be reaffirmed in court. And it's always scary when you go to court, but we keep winning because we're on the right side. And so I'm just full of excitement and love. This couldn't have happened on a better day.
Peterson says the court decision comes as Polynesian canoers depart Juneau on a global voyage to spread the word about the power and beauty of indigenous peoples. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Senator Dan Sullivan says he's trying to close a loophole in the U.S. ban on importing seafood from Russia.
There has been a huge loophole where the Russians have been now sending their fish, it's pollock, it's salmon, a little bit less crab, to other countries for reprocessing, primarily China.
President Joe Biden signed an import ban on Russian seafood last year, saying it would help ensure that Americans were not indirectly financing Russia's war on Ukraine through their purchases. But the United States does not require that seafood imports be traced to their country of origin. So millions of dollars of Russian fish go to China and are then exported to the United States. Last year, the U.S. imported more than $300 million worth of salmon and pollock from China. Some of it was caught in the U.S. and sent to China for processing, but a majority of it likely is from Russia, according to an International Trade Commission report. Sullivan told reporters today that he's talking to officials in the Biden administration about closing the loophole and also sponsoring legislation as he did last year.
Bottom line, what this does is it bans all Russian origin fish wherever it goes to be reprocessed. Again, primarily China. We think this is a really big deal for our country to nail the Russians as they're trying to evade sanctions after their brutal invasion of Ukraine.
Environmental groups and the American pollock industry are among those calling for the loophole to be closed. But U.S. companies that process and sell imported fish oppose bans that decimate their supply. Alaska ranks among the worst states for overall well-being of children. That's the finding of a report released yesterday by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, a national charity focused on child welfare. Organizers of the 2023 Kids Count data book used several metrics to measure the welfare of children in each state, including economic well-being, education, overall health, and supportive family and community connections. Trevor Storrs is president and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust, a statewide organization that advocates for families. He says he thinks there are many factors impacting Alaska families, including economic stress and personal trauma, that need to be addressed collectively.
Our perspective is when we get to parents and children and communities, the knowledge, skills, supports, and resources to lessen that tension, we reduce the risk of not just only child abuse and neglect, but homelessness.
The Kids Count report is released annually, and Alaska has consistently ranked in the bottom third for overall child well-being in recent years. This year, it ranked a little better at 38th in the nation, up from 41st. It's just above Arizona and below Georgia. New Hampshire ranked the highest. As for economic well-being and education, Alaska ranked in the bottom five this year. It's below average in health and above average in family and community connections. Storrs says another potential driver of Alaska's low rankings has to do with the availability and accessibility of childcare. The study found that roughly 13% of Alaska children lived in families where a parent changed, quit, or refused a job because of childcare access or affordability.
Basically, when you look at the annual cost of childcare, it is actually higher than attending university.
Storrs says there needs to be a concerted effort across multiple agencies and departments to address childcare strains in urban communities and a lack of access in rural communities.
One thing won't solve this because we do not have a centralized universal system that is ensuring child care for everybody. And when you don't have a universal system like we have for K through 12, everybody doesn't have access.
Storrs applauded recent efforts made by the state and local governments to tackle the child care crisis. He cited millions of dollars appropriated by the legislature to bolster child care worker wages and Head Start programs and the creation of a child care task force by Governor Mike Dunleavy. Also, Anchorage voters this spring approved allocating marijuana taxes toward childcare and early education. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska researcher shares his fascination for octopuses.
They're reluctant to give up, and if one thing doesn't work, they'll try something else. And I really think that's where a lot of intelligence comes from.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Octopuses are mysterious sea creatures to many people, including in Alaska, where more commercially viable and, dare we say, charismatic animals get the most attention. After all, octopuses do live mostly solitary lives, hiding under rocks, changing color and shape to blend into their surroundings, grabbing prey with their sucker-lined arms and shoving it into their sharp beaks. But our understanding of their biology and behavior has advanced greatly in the last three decades or so, thanks in part to a professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University, Dr. David Scheel. Scheel has a book out called Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses, which is the culmination of many hours spent investigating octopuses underwater and in tide pools. He says eventually he realized he needed to scuba dive to study them well.
You have to bear in mind, my divers have four limbs, the octopus has eight. So we're at a disadvantage to begin with. And so it was a question for me to try and solve is, how big do these guys get? You know, that's not a question with a definitive answer, but the Alaska Pacific octopus does routinely get up to about 100 pounds or more, and occasionally much larger. And so that's a size that's big enough that we wanted to be careful in how we handled them, because we didn't want to put anyone at risk, but we weren't interested in killing or harvesting the octopuses. We wanted to weigh them, measure them, find out whether they are males or females, and put them back.
And then, is it fair to say, I mean, beyond that you've discovered they have a certain intelligence?
Yeah. A lot's been written about octopus intelligence, and for the most part, that hasn't been a central subject of my research. But, you know, the stuff that I do, particularly up here in Alaska, looking at what they're eating and how they're choosing their diet and things like that. And even there, you can see threads of behavior that reveal how their cognition works and what kinds of choices they're making. And one of my favorite examples that I talk about in Many Things Under a Rock is octopuses prefer larger species of prey. And so they're eating small crabs, but they're choosing the bigger species of the crabs in Prince William Sound. And so what does that actually mean the octopus is doing? Well, first of all, they have to be able to judge size. But then they're also using restraint. We know that they're passing up small immediate rewards in order to look for larger rewards in the future. They are very clever animals, but really what I think the building blocks of octopus intelligence are really curiosity, persistence, and flexibility. So they're always exploring things, they're reluctant to give up, and if one thing doesn't work, they'll try something else. And I really think that's where a lot of intelligence comes from, including in humans.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, there are many ways that yourself and other researchers have gone into the ocean to look at different animals, and in your case, octopuses. And then you sort of famously also have had an octopus living in your house.
Yeah, you're referring to the PBS documentary Octopus Making Contact. And that was originally envisioned as sort of a scientist and the octopus he keeps in his home. But fortunately, my daughter Laurel, who's the illustrator for the book, by the way, has done some marvelous drawings to put in the book, she kind of bonded with Heidi. And so that really changed the whole nature of that documentary and made it, in some ways, this charming piece about a girl and her octopus, which I think was a much better story than a scientist and his octopus.
Well, I mean, I can imagine that you both had a lot of interactions with Heidi. And so I wondered, I mean, were there things that you felt like by having her in your home that you learned that you would not have otherwise?
Yeah, Heidi was great to have in the home. And one of the things that happened is that she really wanted to interact with us. And I was surprised to find I had my desk set up when I would work from home, where I had a really good view of the aquarium that Heidi was in. And Heidi would get up, she would see me at my desk, and she would get up out of her den and come to the nearest corner of the tank. And then she would go up and down from the surface of the water to the bottom, from the surface of the water up and down until I would look up. And then she would, you know, she didn't wave or anything like that, because that's not a natural behavior for octopuses as far as we know. But she would change her behavior a little bit, notice me noticing her. And she wanted me to get up and come and play with her. And if I didn't, if I tried to get back to work, out of the corner of my eye, I would see her doing that pacing behavior again.
It seems like people, you know, with certain animals and how we think about them, for humans, it's like easier to relate to like another primate. And obviously octopuses are very different from that. And as people sort of begin to understand and begin to acknowledge the intelligence in this creature, are they then, I guess, more obligated to help protect them?
Well, I think it's very easy for us to identify with octopuses. I mean, they've got the same kind of vision we do. And they're, particularly once you learn to work with them a little bit, they're very enamored of touch, and we are too. And so they become very endearing animals. And when you add to that sort of this notion of octopus awareness, right, that they have inner lives, that they experience hunger and fear, or, you know, that they might be dreaming and having dreams and nightmares, then it becomes very easy to identify with them. But in terms of what does that mean, how should we behave, that's a question that's more about us than it is about octopuses themselves. So maybe, you know, you get to a point where, like me, you think, well, I'm just not going to eat any of these animals that I, you know, feel attached to. I don't eat octopuses anymore because their behavior, you know, that's more interesting to me than any culinary experience I could have with an octopus. But that really says something about our culture particularly. And then if you look at indigenous cultures, which harvest some of these animals, they have a very different relationship, right? Because to them, this is part of their cultural heritage. It's part of how they relate to the world. It's part of how indigenous cultures see people not as separate from nature, but as part of nature. Octopuses have to eat, right? And they eat clams and crabs. Well, people have to eat as well. And so when you're looking at these choices, my feeling is that you have to place them in the proper context. The properties of the animal alone do not determine how we should relate to that animal.
That was Dr. David Scheel, a marine biology professor at Alaska Pacific University and author of Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
A warming climate has scientists wanting to know more than ever what's living in Alaska's rivers and streams. Specifically, what species live in the anadromous freshwater streams where migratory fish return from saltwater to spawn? Biologists and others are hoping that a new phone app will encourage Alaskans to help map these fish habitats. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
Alaska has over 46,000 miles of shoreline, more than the rest of the country combined. Sandy Beach in Petersburg is one tiny sliver of it. It's a popular park with a playground and shelters for picnics. A creek cuts a shallow channel across the sand into Frederick Sound. In late summer, it fills with pink salmon heading into spawn. Away from the beach and a few steps into the park's tree line, there is a tiny tributary of the creek. That's where I meet Eric Castro, a fish biologist with the U.S. Forest Service.
This is an uncharted stream as far as the Forest Service has on our records.
Castro is here to use the new Fish Map app to catalog what's in the water. The app supplies a form that anyone can fill out to nominate fish they find. If approved, the fish will be added to the Alaska Anadromous Waters Catalog. This tiny stream is not recognized in the federal database at all. The state's catalog lists it, but not all the species living here. Castro wants to add cutthroat trout to the state's list because he's seen them here before, so he's set up a few minnow traps. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has categorized over 21,000 anadromous waterways since the 60s.
It's a massive data set.
Joe Giefer manages the state's anadromous waters catalog. Although the catalog includes all major systems in the state, Giefer says there is no way to cover all the smaller streams. He hopes the phone app will get others to document fish they see in streams while out in the field, too.
There's a lot of water in Alaska. There's a lot of remote areas.
Giefer says the catalog data is used by local, state, and federal agencies and provides protections from possible development projects. So the more data that's added to the catalog, the better. Minnow traps like Castro's take permits, but Giefer says documenting adult fish would be very useful too, like those found spawning. That's where local knowledge can help, says Aaron Poe with the Alaska Conservation Foundation. He coordinates the phone app, which is supported by a large partnership of federal, state, tribal, and nonprofit groups. They started testing the app last year and hope to get more users involved.
Local folks really do know best where the anadromous fish are. So whether that's indigenous knowledge that dates back for millennia or whether that's local knowledge from families that grew up in a region or some combination of both, those folks really know where the fish are.
Poe says there is increased interest in what fish are where because of climate change.
Essentially, we're having some of these anadromous fish, whether they're salmon or whitefish or other species, that are starting to move into other areas of the state.
The Aleut community of St. Paul Island created the Fish Map app through its Indigenous Sentinels Network, which runs about a dozen apps. Hannah Marie Garcia with the St. Paul tribe says they wanted to provide a useful tool to document ecosystem shifts. St. Paul is 300 miles offshore in the Bering Sea, so they also wanted to make sure it was usable in remote areas. Garcia says the app doesn't require internet.
If they don't have Wi-Fi or cell signal, it just stays on the device until they then come to a place, maybe they're back in town or, you know, they're back from the fishing ground or they're back from wherever they were hiking to go find that stream. When they finally have signal, they can then upload to the database after the fact.
Back at Sandy Beach Park, Castro pulls a minnow trap from a shaded pool underneath a log. Soon, two young girls push through the brush along the bank.
We're doing some minnow trapping. And look at this. So we have a coho is a smaller one. And then a cutthroat is the bigger one right there.
Cool.
Yeah, so these fish right here are living in this water, in this little teeny stream.
Cool.
Crazy, huh?
Yeah.
So near to Sandy Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that there were fish in this stream?
No.
Later, Castro uses the phone app to fill out a nomination form, including all kinds of information. Location, weather, and details about the stream and fish. First, the nomination will be checked by Garcia's Indigenous Sentinels Network before going to the state for confirmation. That can take months. The state updates its catalog once a year. Last year, the app's first year, produced 13 nominations. The app advocates hope to receive thousands more in the future. There is an incentive, too. For people who take the time to fill out a nomination for a local stream, they'll receive $100. Reporting for Coast Alaska in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Find out more about the Fish Mapping app at the program's website, alaskafishmapping.org. First place finishers in the race to Alaska sailed into Ketchikan early Wednesday after 5 days and 18 hours on the water. KRBD's Reagan Miller watched from the dock as they rang the finishing bell and has this report.
Yeah! Woo! Oh, yeah! We Break for Whales' 8-person crew stumbled off the boat just before 6 a.m. with linked arms, murmuring about cookie dough and reminiscing about all the whales they saw. They jumped, hugged, and popped open a bottle of champagne, and a few cans of beer, and a box of cinnamon rolls. We Break for Whales was the first team to cross the finish line in the storied race that takes competitors from Port Townsend, Washington, through Victoria, British Columbia, and finally to Ketchikan. A small welcome party was waiting for the team with questions, especially about their time near Dixon Entrance, where it was windy with some rough chop. Weather can be a problem when the major rule of the race is no motors.
Did you see like 40 knots like the forecast said? How was it?
Wasn't 40, but we definitely saw 28.
A little lumpy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was a
The whole boat was catching air and then landing in the troughs.
It made it very interesting.
The team worked with little sleep in the final leg of the journey. They reported gusts around 30 miles an hour the day before they sailed into Ketchikan. This was team member Maisie Bryant's second race. She says there's just something about the weirdest human-powered boat race in Alaska.
I enjoy it. I like the adventure. It's beautiful. It, like, disconnects you from society a little bit and just makes it simpler.
Bryant says the crew had no problems sailing together.
We all had great personalities, super positive. They kept it different, and if someone needed a nap, we always had an extra person, and we were able to keep the boat somewhat organized and the food coming through.
They might not have slept during the last 24 hours of the race, but they did eat.
So we actually pre-cooked and froze dinners. And then for breakfast, we pre-made some burritos, we had some oatmeal, and lunch was kind of like grab-and-go sandwiches. So we ate so well, plus our cookies. Can't forget the cookies.
Nikki Henderson, who hails from the United Kingdom, is another returner. She says she did it again for the adventure.
The race has like an amazing balance of adventure and kind of community and like the sense of freedom and curiosity of not just the world but also like humankind, I guess, and humanity and the limits to what you can do. And I think like when you're feeling, when life's not super smooth, it's good to get yourself into that environment because it's so empowering, I think, when you do something like that.
And Henderson says the boat really lived up to its name. The crew saw a ton of whales and watched them bubble feed for a long time.
It was like being on David Attenborough or something.
As the first place team, We Break for Whales gets the glory and $10,000, but not the treasured steak knives. That's up for grabs by whichever team makes it in next. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rhonda McBride, Liz Ruskin and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.